Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know and that the mainstream media is not reporting. Today, we're going to talk about Brown versus Board of Education. It was 50 years ago last Monday that the United States Supreme Court came down unanimously with its decision that segregation, at least in public schools, was wrong. And what a different nation we were 50 years ago. Most African Americans, or at least a large number of them, felt that they could only be employed in very, very small numbers outside of fields such as maids and janitors and gardeners. They are separate movie theaters for blacks and whites, or they had to sit in balconies, particularly in the South. Most blacks were not allowed to vote. Sure, they had the right to vote under the 14th and 15th Amendment of the United States Constitution, but in practice there were all kinds of ways to keep blacks from voting. Everything from grandfather clauses that said that you had to have your grandfather had to be able to vote, and that made sure that blacks still wouldn't be able to vote, to literacy tests, to poll taxes, keeping them out. Jim Crow was throughout the South. Indeed, in the early 1960s, there were even separate water fountains for blacks and whites. Well, it seems like that is long behind us. There are no separate water fountains anymore, separate movie theaters. The 1964 Civil Rights Act made sure that blacks and whites could mingle together at hotels and restaurants and so forth. And while in many ways it indirectly helped end Jim Crow, helped end the problem of segregation in the South in all manner of ways outside of schools, in the schools, I'm not so sure it did such a good job. Clearly there's no legal segregation anymore in public schools, but as you increasingly look at public schools across the country, you'll see that a lot of them are still white and black. Are we still separate and unequal? Hillary Shelton, he's the director of the NAACP office in Washington, D.C. He and I actually worked together when I worked as legislative counsel for Congressman Barney Frank on a number of civil rights issues. And I'm very glad to welcome him here on the show. Mr. Shelton, welcome to the show.
The vision of Brown has not been completed. Quite frankly, we came a long way from 1954 until the mid-70s. Our country seemed to be a lot more specifically and intensely focused on actually eliminating the vestiges of segregation in our society, of course, beginning with our public schools. And in essence, we'd achieved quite a bit. By the mid-1970s, we found that our country had moved to a point where almost 70% of all African Americans were being educated in integrated schools using a series of tools and other programs to help integrate our society. However, we've lost a few steps now. Today, as we sit, only about a little over 30%, almost 40% of African Americans are being educated in integrated school systems. And, of course, there's still a number of other problems we have to contend with in our society, such as closing the achievement gap, addressing access issues, and even issues that actually create the biggest problems for segregation in our school system, which is our living patterns. That is, we still live in quite polarized communities. We can't call it legal segregation, as you mentioned earlier, but indeed we still live in very polarized communities in which you kind of know whether you're African American or not by looking at your zip code in America today. So we've come a long way, but there's an awful lot of ways to go.
I actually want to address all these issues in some detail. One of the nice things about a radio show versus a television program is you can discuss these issues in detail. It's not just spin and sound bites. I do want to invite my listeners to call in as well. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. It's toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. And call in, ask Mr. Shelton or myself any question you want. How do you feel about busing? How do you feel about redrawing school districts? How do you feel about taking actions today that could more reintegrate our schools? What do you think is causing the achievement gap? And also the poverty. Greater percentage of blacks live in poverty today than whites. Call in, let yourself be heard. Again, 877-57-SCOOP, which is also 877-577-2667, or you can email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Mr. Shelton, I want to go through, I guess, each of those things that I raised. Let's start with why we're moving backwards. I mean, as you pointed out, we moved forward into the 70s, and now is it white flight from cities? Is it the end of busing? Why are we moving backwards here?
I think we've seen a few things. We've seen some pushback from a number of communities. As you know, what integration basically meant, as we talked about busing, is that black children were bused into white communities. And, of course, the reason that happened is because most of the resources disproportionately went into and still go into predominantly white communities throughout our country. As a result, there was no real integration going both ways. Black kids entered white mainstream society through busing programs in public schools, but it didn't happen the other way. There was some push back then as we began to see a number of things. Number one, as you mentioned, the Great White Flight. Many of our urban areas, St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, and other places, we saw a big movement as African Americans were moving into communities that were once predominantly white. White Americans began moving out. Property values plummeted because of the fear that the property values were going to plummet. And so homes were bought up by African Americans hoping to achieve the American dream and moving into inner city areas to not only access a better way of life, greater opportunities for jobs and business opportunities, but also a better place to have their children educated.
Well, let me ask you about white flight, because
sure.
How do we in a free society, I think you and I definitely agree that desegregation is good, that diversity and integration is good. How do we in a free society prevent people from making private choices that end up in greatly segregated neighborhoods? I mean, you look at a city like Chicago, and it seems like the whole South Side is black and the North and West Side are white. How do we stop that?
Well, I think, quite frankly, you make the whole thing very attractive. That it is, there are good reasons people want to live in inner city areas. Inner city areas are much more convenient to shopping. They're much more convenient to jobs in inner city areas. There's good reasons for people to actually stay in the cities. Public transportation is a lot more plentiful in many cities. There's much more to do, whether it's sports games and arenas and other places. Whether it's just great restaurants and the whole bit. So there are good reasons to be there. Eliminating some of the false fears that people had. Again, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy in the early 70s. What we saw is that as African Americans moved in, white Americans became very fearful that their property values were going to plummet. And as you and I both know, your property is probably one of the most fundamental things that you will ever own.
Right.
Property ownership very well determines whether you'll live out the later years of your life in grace and dignity, or whether you'll live it out in squalor poverty.
I'm curious to talk here at home. You and I both live in Washington, D.C.,
sure.
Which Northwest Washington and Capitol Hill tend to be majority white areas, and just about the rest of the city tends to be not just majority, but some, I don't know, 70-80% more African American. What can be done in Washington, D.C. to help reintegrate? I mean, D.C., in fact, was one of the original schools. People don't know the Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Topeka, Kansas was just one of the five cities. Actually,
right.
Washington, D.C. was one of the five. And I got to tell you, someone lives in Washington. I still drive by and I see pretty much all black schools and mostly white schools as well. Well, what do we do here at home?
Well, very well. We're starting to see things happen in D.C. that are just extraordinary. As you know, there's a big movement in the other direction now that we're seeing more and more white Americans moving back into the city of Washington.
That's true.
The shift is underway now. And the kind of things we talked about is strategies that happen here. As you know, the city was even more overwhelmingly African American during the 1970s.
Okay.
We'd reached a point where it was almost 70% African American. Well, we're down, a little over 70%, please excuse me. We're down now to about 60% African American.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Absolutely, with a greater number of white Americans moving back into Washington, D.C. and areas. We're seeing great development in the U Street corridor, and we're seeing housing prices begin to really go through the roof as we're seeing this integration continue to move. In other words, the example of D.C. is an example that shows that not only can you have greater integrated cities, as we're seeing that movement in that direction, but also it doesn't mean your property value is going to go down. Our property value here is probably one of the highest, or certainly growing at one of the fastest rates of any other city in the country.
Are they going up in black areas as well, or mostly in
yes.
the Northwest? Okay.
You see it going up everywhere, but D.C. is extraordinary. If you want to look at cities that have that kind of better represent the realities of the rest of the country, D.C. really is extraordinary because of its relationship to the government and other things along those lines. So our unemployment rate is better than most cities. Our property values are higher than most cities. So D.C. is extraordinary.
Well, let me ask you one more question about D.C., if I could, because I'm always debating conservatives. I regularly do live debates with members of the Bush administration. And one of the things they always throw out at me, and I don't have a good answer for, so I'm going to ask you the question, is they say, and maybe it's not true, and if it's not true, you can let me know right here.
Sure.
I always point out the differences in resources that you pointed out between not just white schools and black schools, but rich schools and poor schools. In this country, there's no question that property taxes decide how much goes to education, and if you live in a rich neighborhood, you can have higher property taxes and you get better public schools, and you pay teachers more. But they always throw out that the District of Columbia pays its students more on average than the rest of America, and yet its students aren't doing so well. One, is that true? Is that statistic true? And number two, if it is true, how do you account for that?
Well, we do pay our teachers at a very competitive rate. There's no question about that. And I think the point is also true that it's not just about the resources. That D.C. does okay in terms of resources. There's so much more that we can do in D.C., not only in the resource department, but also in the organization, in the areas of organization, the areas of curriculum, and other things that are necessary to actually be successful in D.C. There's no question that we can do many, many things to improve. But resources have to be addressed as well. But you have to have a plan and a program.
So is it the D.C. schools just are just uniquely not as good compared to other schools across the country?
No, I strongly disagree with that.
All right, okay.
D.C. has very competitive schools. One of the very fascinating things about D.C. is that you can go to a D.C. public school in one neighborhood, and you'll see test scores going through the roof. You can go in the same city under the same Board of Education in just another part of another community and find that the test scores are dwindling behind. In one school, one area you go into, and you'll find the school's doing great. The teacher-student ratio is just most opportune, and the students are just doing wonderfully.
So what separates?
You find that this is riddled with crime, and students don't have the opportunity to really concentrate on their subject matter. They're finding themselves either shivering in the wintertime with their coats on, trying to keep warm, or ducking bullets when they go outside of the school.
Now, so is that what mostly determines the difference then? Crime, poverty, discipline problems? I mean, is that the difference between our good schools and our bad schools? And let me give out the numbers one more second. 877-57-SCOOP. Hillary Shelton's only on for the first half an hour, so if you want to ask him a question, you should call now. 877-57-SCOOP. Go ahead, Mr. Shelton.
So we know there's some things that work. We know if we can shrink class sizes so there's a more advantageous student-teacher ratio, we know that those students will get the kind of individual attention that they deserve and need to be successful. We know if we can have the most up-to-date technology in the classroom, the broadband networks coming in so that students can communicate with other students all over the country and have access to Internet libraries, that there's to actually place in those areas in poor communities. That would be extremely helpful as well. We know we have to do some things to actually rebuild some of our existing public schools in D.C. I don't know if you remember a couple years ago, schools had to open late because roofs were caving in and plaster was peeling off walls. We need resources to be able to focus in and do those things and not just be dictated by politics, but have the politic actually dictated by the real needs of the communities that our schools are placed in, and our teachers need to be retrained to meet the demands of the issues that they need to teach in those classrooms today. We're looking at the president's budget, and we see that in his budget to finally try to actually pay for the historic No Child Left Behind Act, and indeed his budget comes in $9 billion. Below the authorized level, meaning that a number of programs and issues in our education system are simply not going to be addressed.
Well, I guess the question that I want to ask, and I really want to sort of be able to answer critics, is I definitely see the resource problem. There's no question that the students in rich areas do better than students in poor areas. There's no question about that. But is it fair to say, and if it's unfair, please let me know. I'd like to tell them it's unfair. Is it fair to say that the District of Columbia, for example, and I really just mean it as an example, is getting more resources than most and is still doing worse than most? And
I wouldn't say that. I don't think they get more resources than most. I mean, one of the things that really throws the assessment off is, for instance, you know that the last budget that was passed also includes a premise that we have to give one-third of our education budget for kids to move out of the public school system and into private schools.
Yeah.
We
now, that's specific to
D.C.,
right.
D.C. about school vouchers.
Right.
When you go into communities that the school systems do very well in suburban areas, you find that there's not a debate about school vouchers. And the reason they're not debating about school vouchers is because the parents and the community has control over their own schools. Here in D.C., we have a mayor that's actually trying to take that control away from the school board and put it more under his own auspices instead of maintaining the diversity necessary of a school board elected from communities throughout the city to determine what's in the best interest of those communities that they're to serve.
Let me move back to the question of black and white. Even in schools that are fairly integrated, there's still a significant achievement gap on average between blacks and whites. Obviously, that's an average. There certainly are some exceptionally good black students and some exceptionally bad white students. But is that because of poverty, or are there other factors at play here?
Well, there are other factors at play as well. Very well, if we had a situation in which you found that of white students in a given school district were failing, there'd be a major review of the curriculum, the test vehicle that's been being utilized to determine whether they're doing well, and other concerns within the school too. They'd assess the teachers that are actually bringing the education process to these particular students, and very well say, look, there's a real problem with how the system's working. They wouldn't pigeonhole the students or put labels on them. They look at how the process is moving and whatnot. What we find out in too many communities, whether it's in Miami, Florida, or Washington, D.C., that the same kind of sensitivity to the cultural diversity is not really being recognized. We know that students learn in different ways. Some students learn with phonics better than other systems of learning. If we're seeing that students that are from a particular racial or ethnic minority grouping are struggling with a particular teaching style or structure, then indeed we would need to revisit those structures, revisit those strategies for education, and make sure they very well fit these students. I'm not suggesting that you set the standards any lower, because you don't.
Well, give me an example, if you would, of structures that you would change.
Well, sure. The emphasis on kind of the centric focus of the particular education program you're utilizing. We know that, for instance, African-American boys is a good example. I'm the father of three African-American boys.
Okay.
They have a tremendous amount of energy. The teachers that work with them that do their best understand that and begin to focus that energy in a way that's extremely constructive. I believe I have three of the smartest boys I've ever known. But indeed, I know it takes a different strategy in working with those three boys than it does in working with kids that may not have quite as much energy going on and quite as much diversity in their focus.
You know,
that's
interesting. Go ahead.
There's strategies that you utilize for kids that have a tendency to act that way and learn that way, and not pigeonhole or label them to suggest somehow they have a learning disorder.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if that's a black-white difference or not, but I taught an inner-city school for a semester. That's all I did. But when I was in law school, it was a program to teach street law. And we went into it was in New Haven, Connecticut, and in fact it was the school I taught in was probably 98% black and 2% Latino. I don't think there were any whites in the school other than some of the teachers. And I saw really awful, awful teaching. In fact, the teacher I replaced sat in the back of the room. I actually came in to observe his class, and he sat in the back of the room. He told the kids to turn their social studies book to page whatever, 322, and then he had them read from the book for the whole 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew those kids weren't learning anything. In fact, the kids, if they said a word and they mispronounced it, he didn't even correct them. that a lot of times they would just skip it. I don't think the teacher was really watching what was going on. Later on, I found that that teacher was paid $19,000 a year, which is probably why they couldn't get a decent teacher there. So I know resources matter. I was just going to say that when I taught there, what I did is I did a lot of acting out. In fact, I had kids, you know, okay, you're stopped by a policeman, you play the policeman, you play, you know, what are your rights? And they became very active and very much enjoyed that kind of teaching. But I do think there are different ways that you can teach kids. Let me give out the numbers again. 877-57-SCOOP. We have to go to a quick commercial break. But when we come back, it'll be your chance to discuss 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education with Hillary Shelton, director of the Washington, D.C. NAACP. And you can also send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
Despicable is not a word that major corporate executives are used to having hurled at them by high elected officials, but the honchos of Diebold Inc. recently got this very word right in their corporate face. The hurler was Kevin Shelley, California's Secretary of State, and he was referring to his experience with Diebold's electronic voting machines in California's March primary elections. Computer glitches plagued that election, jeopardizing its outcome. For example, thousands of San Diego voters were turned away from the polls because Diebold machines malfunctioned. A subsequent investigation by a state panel of experts on electronic voting found that this company, the second largest purveyor of touchscreen voting machines in the country, had violated state law by installing untested and uncertified software in its machines, then lied about it. Their performance, their behavior is despicable, Shelley bluntly said. He also put action behind his words, banning the use of more than 14,000 Diebold machines for this November's election, saying that the machines are not secure and reliable. He also recommended that criminal charges be filed for what he called fraudulent actions by Diebold. Shelley had earlier ruled that by 2006, touchscreen voting machines in California must produce a paper receipt so voters can verify the electoral choices they make on these corruptible computers. But after this year's unpleasantness with Diebold, Shelley says he's now exploring ways to speed up this requirement. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, in Maryland, a voters group has filed suit to block the use of all 16,000 of Diebold's virtual voting machines in their state unless a paper verification system is installed on each of them. It's all a part of the growing grassroots rebellion to prevent the electronic theft of our elections. To join the fight, go to www.verifiedvoting.org.
It's the stick it where it hurts to feel well patch. Works in a hurry to feel well patch. Lasts a long time to feel well. Well patch, it brings you back to well patch.
Is pain keeping you from feeling well? Try the immediate, long-lasting pain relief of well patch. Well patch comes in a full line of pain-relieving patches that soothes your specific pain. For backache, arthritis, muscle pain, or stiff neck, put on a well patch.
Well patch, it brings you back to well patch.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We are discussing Brown versus Board of Education. It's 50 years after the decision. And the question is, are we still separate and unequal here in America? That we still have today a, I think my guest Hillary Shelton said 70%, is that right, of black students still attend majority black schools, is that right?
That's correct.
70%, and I know that most they're very, you know, most white students also probably attend 80-90% white schools. And it's a difficult problem, and I want to give out the numbers again. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, if you want to call in and ask Mr. Shelton a question. Or you can send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Mr. Shelton, even when we have integrated schools, there's a phenomena called the lunchroom problem, I guess, where you see, at least in some schools, and maybe it's gone down. Hopefully it has gone down. But where you see black kids sitting together, white kids sitting together, do you think that's still a problem? And how do you get into people's, into personal decisions like that?
Well, number one, I think just interest is what ends up happening. Us being able to spend more time together and understand that we do have a convergence in interest. What you'll also find in those same cafeterias is that you'll see the football team, as integrated as it might be, sitting together. You'll see the basketball team, as integrated as it might be, sitting together, the cheerleaders
yep.
sitting together.
Okay.
And then you'll see other students kind of sitting together across interest lines. So there needs to be a push. People need to think about talking to folks who are a little bit different than themselves. But we're still, as human beings, regardless of race, gender, ethnicity, we still end up finding ourselves looking for people that are most like ourselves. And race is still one of those criteria to sit down and talk with and feel comfortable with.
And I do think it's gone down a lot, certainly across the nation. Certainly people are used to working very much with people of different races. And I guess one of my questions is, in terms of the achievement gap between blacks and whites, is part of that due to family structures and people carrying, what's going on there?
I think you have a number of things going on. Now, first, you begin talking about the kinds of things people are being tested on. Certainly, dinner table conversation, is something that's clearly part of our points of reference. If your father is a doctor and comes home talking about, experiences at work in surgery and things like that, those are the issues you're comfortable with. If your father is and mother are engineers or whatever they do, if they're talking about what they do, those are the issues you're most comfortable in. Those are the things that are actually being presented in our education system and are things that will hopefully lead us to professional careers. As such, African-American students are still emerging. We still know that 32% of African-Americans live in poverty, as opposed to 14% of white children. And what that means is that our parents, the mother and the father, if there's a mother and a father in the household, are more likely to have less than professional jobs. The exposure is a lot different in the communities they live in. So that they're not talking to people that are in those professional careers about issues that are also consistent with our academic experiences.
Well, let me ask you this. It's 50 years after Brown versus Board
sure.
of Education. It's 40 years after the Civil Rights Act. And we see, some of this cycle of poverty continuing. We're already in the next generation, not the generation that lived under segregation, but their children. What can be done to break this cycle of poverty? Affirmative action, would that help it, or something else?
It has to be comprehensive. Poverty is a very comprehensive thing in our communities and throughout our country. We have to be comprehensive. One of the strategies in addressing the issues of education was, education is that bridge over troubled water. It's that ladder out of poverty. If you can become well-educated, you have a greater opportunity and greater possibilities of being well-to-do, and then you begin passing those things on to your children as well. Education is not only used as a thing that gets you an opportunity to compete for good jobs, but education has been before and still is now one of the biggest obstacles for the opportunity to compete for better jobs and a better life, and even getting loans to start your own business and things of that nature. So moving in the direction of making sure that, number one, everyone has access to quality education. Before we start talking about things like school voucher and what they've been referring to as school choice, we have to make sure that all of our children across the country have real opportunity to get a good education, real options to get good, quality, comprehensive education so they can move on with their lives. That's important. Number two, we have to recognize that a lot of poverty is self-generated. That is, poverty, unless we are very deliberate about wanting to move people out of poverty, not just off of welfare rolls, but actually move people out of poverty, then indeed we will continue this awful cycle of poverty in our society. We want people to be able to get good education, great opportunity for jobs. We want to create new jobs and a stronger economy. We know that the crime rate and everything else gets better as the economy is stronger.
So programs to help people get homes, get job training, better education, housing loans, things like that would help.
Absolutely, absolutely. We know the reason our schools are still as segregated as they are now is because we live in very segregated communities. We know those communities are as economically segregated as they are racially segregated.
Yeah.
So addressing those issues are extremely important as well.
Let me ask you about some more controversial topics in terms of repairing the damage. There's no question in the 70s, as you pointed out, there was less segregation. Due to things like busing and different school districts and things like that. How does the NAACP feel about rebusing or redrawing school districts again?
Well, we believe that we have to work towards a very well integrated society. That busing was a tool because people didn't live close together, because we lived in a very segregated communities. Let's move towards addressing a number of issues. We have not given up on busing. We think busing can be a very helpful tool. As you and I both know, the only time people disagree with utilizing busing to get kids to school is if when we tell you the primary reason we're using busing is to make sure that we have kids in integrated schools.
Or maybe just the distance. I often felt that if you could find a way to not make kids travel too far, a lot of the resistance to busing might go down.
Well, and let's have incentives for people to actually live in the same communities. There's a great example in Yellow Springs, Ohio, of the communities being very deliberate about wanting very well integrated communities that recognize the realities of how integration had in the past affected property values, and they took very deliberative steps to help prevent those kind of problems from occurring. As such, they have extremely well-integrated communities, and we're seeing great success.
Let me give out the numbers one more time. 877-57-SCOOP. I know you have to go soon. 877-577-2667. I do want to ask you about affirmative action and where you think affirmative action is necessary still in our society and where it's no longer needed.
Well, I think that it's still very well necessary in our society today. If we look at the quality of life index across the board, we see that African Americans still end up at the lower end of the spectrum for just about everything. And many other racial and ethnic minority people experience very similar experiences in our country. We know that we look at the unemployment rate, that the African American unemployment rate is always twice that of the overall society. If you look at our ability to even matriculate through colleges and universities, we know that even though we've come to relative parity in our abilities to graduate from high school, our ability to matriculate through universities and professional programs is still very much is quite far behind. If we look at income, we know that we still have vast income differences, even for people that work in the same areas. For some reason, racial and ethnic minorities make less money with the same amount of training in the same job arena than our white counterparts. And women, of course, have some problems as well, but we're talking about race right now, so I'm kind of focusing on race.
Sure.
So affirmative action is still quite necessary. I think the question you ask is, when will we get to the point that we no longer need tools like affirmative action to help fully integrate our society? I think we won't need programs like affirmative action at a time when you won't even notice that it's there. In essence, the tool of affirmative action, flexible goals and timetables in helping to move towards a more integrated society, is something that you won't even notice is in place when we've actually reached the point of there being parity across the board in all the quality of life indicators.
What about those that would argue that, you know, there's certain professions that there are less black symphony musicians, there are less white basketball players, that maybe we don't need sort of parity across the board? How do you address that?
Well, I think they're missing the point. I think the issue is that the opportunity should be open for all Americans, and false obstacles that prevent people from being able to go into the fields of their choice is something that very well needs to be eviscerated. We know that we have that if that there are many African Americans I talk to that would love to go into the areas of medicine, though we're seeing that we are sorely underrepresented in the areas of medicine. They love to go into the areas of engineering, and we see that we're sorely behind in our ability to matriculate through colleges and universities providing those kinds of services and those kind of programs. There's so many other areas that I know that the children of various other racial and ethnic minority groupings would love to go into, but because of the obstacle of being able to have good quality education from the very beginning, pre-K through 12 and then on to college and university is something we have to take on. We also know that access to colleges and universities is becoming extremely difficult, even increasingly so.
Yeah, I was just going to say
college education has increased significantly,
but medical school
in the past are no longer in place.
I was just going to say medical school and engineering schools; these things cost a lot of money.
Yeah, and if you look at the programs we've used to help kind of close that gap, programs like Pell Grants. We know that a Pell Grant today will barely pay a third of your tuition at even a subsidized college or university. So we need to be very deliberate about making sure that we eliminate the obstacles that prevent kids from being able to compete, from being able to go to the colleges and universities that their minds would very well take them to, instead of worrying about whether their parents' pocketbooks will be able to allow them this opportunity.
I think that's a great point. And, Mr. Shaw, I've just got one more question here, and this is from a listener, and I don't want to mispronounce your name. It's Nguyen, I think, N-G-U-Y-E-N, from Mount Clemens, Michigan. He writes, does the NAACP support the concerns of other minorities, such as Hispanic and Asian Americans? Do blacks as the majority minority vanguard the rights of other American minorities?
The NAACP works very closely with many other racial and ethnic minority organizations. We work with the Organization of Chinese Americans, the Japanese American Citizens League, the Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium, and the Asian communities are all very close and good friends of ours. We work with the National Council of the RAS, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the League of United Latin American Citizens and the Hispanic community all the time. We work with the National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund and the Native American communities all the time. We work with women's organizations like NOW, and we work with labor unions like the AFL-CIO, the United Auto Workers, and many others, because we have a very, very similar agenda in the area of justice and civil rights. So we do work very closely with many other civil rights organizations of various racial and ethnic groups.
I just want to second that, Nguyen. When I worked in Congress for Congressman Barney Frank on the Judiciary Committee, we were constantly making alliances between all those various groups because we share many of the same concerns, and the NAACP was absolutely there when we needed them on issues of women's rights, issues of gay rights, issues of Asian American rights, it's labor rights. It's not just looking out for blacks, and I very much want to credit the NAACP for that. Mr. Shelton, thank you very much for this interview. I appreciate it. I know you have to go, but I want to thank you very much for appearing on the Inside Scoop, this 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education.
I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll invite me back, and look forward to talking to you again.
I absolutely will. If you want to call in and ask a question, Mr. Shelton has to go, but feel free to do so. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about schools. Let's talk about whether we're still a separate, unequal society today and what we can do about it. Again, 877-57-SCOOP, or send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
The Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. This week, meat processing giant Tyson Foods gave 42 immigrant workers the axe at a Harrisburg, Virginia plant for not being able to provide legal employment documentation. Another 18 employees are also under investigation for not being able to provide legal employment documentation. Another 18 employees are also under investigation. Tyson's corporate headquarters say they randomly checked the Social Security numbers of their 120,000 employees. However, all 63 workers questioned have Latino surnames that could have made them a target. After a three-year investigation, six Tyson executives were indicted in an immigrant smuggling scheme in 2001, but they were acquitted of the charges last year.
It appears that the boycott against Taco Bell, organized by farm workers in Florida who pick their produce and live in abject poverty, may be making some headway. At the annual meeting of Taco Bell's parent company, Yum Brands, held yesterday, CEO David Novak said he'd support a wage increase for the coalition of Immokalee workers, the first in more than a decade, provided the boycott.
125 workers solicited money from a database provided by the Republican National Committee.
The House of Representatives approved a bill this week that would weaken the power of the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. The bill would extend the amount of time companies would be allowed to appeal citations and penalties for unsafe working conditions and would also expand the eligibility of companies to receive reimbursement for attorney's fees for fighting OSHA-related claims. The bill's chances in the Senate are less certain. Other legislation pending there would actually strengthen penalties for worker safety violations.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. A study released this week by the Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo found laws banning smoking in bars and restaurants dramatically reduced levels of indoor air pollution, which were 82% less than in workplaces that allowed smoking. The study also found that full-time bar and restaurant employees were exposed to more than four times the average annual limits of fine particulate air pollution recommended by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hear how Ford Motor Company has become a literary figure today on Hightower Radio. Writers used to sacrifice for their art, subsisting on stale biscuits and cheap wine, letting their health go as they wrote day and night. No such suffering for Carol Matthews, though. She's a British writer of what is called edgy romantic comedy novels aimed at young contemporary women. And rather than sacrifice, she has simply sold her artistic self to Ford Motor Company. In the latest intrusion of corporate advertising into every nook and cranny of everyone's existence, Ford has paid a pile of money to Miss Matthews in exchange for her pledge literally to write the company's products into her romantic novels. It seems that Ford is eager to pitch its Fiesta car to 28 to 35-year-old women on their way up the career ladder. Apparently, this is the very demographic that Matthews' books reach. Chick lit, it's known in the biz. So Ford has become a literary character. For example, in a special short story written for the company, she drops in a reference to, quote, whizzing around Buckinghamshire in Imogene, a rather snazzy Ford Fiesta complete with 6 CD changer, air conditioning, and thoroughly comfy seats. Art meets ad copy, and ad copy wins by a knockout. Matthews, who also is appearing in ads for Ford, says she's not troubled by this corporatization of her work. Quote, I've been very pleased with Ford in that they haven't put any constraints on my writing at all, she gushed. Well, good gollies, Ms. Matthews, I'm sure they won't, as long as you keep writing breathless copy like that. But what have you tried to, you know, test your corporate freedom by writing something like, whizzing around Buckinghamshire, my snazzy Ford Fiesta sputtered and died on me again, just as the 6 CD changer went on the fritz and spewed blue smoke in my face. This is Jim Hightower saying, who would buy a particular car just because some writer mentions it in a novel? And Ford wonders why it's falling behind Japanese car makers?
Toyota owners, tired of paying high gas prices? Well, how about paying nothing? That's right. Toyota is giving away free gas for a year to 12 lucky winners. Plus, 1,000 more will win $50 fill-ups. Just come into your participating Toyota dealer to enter the sweepstakes. You'll get the very best competitively priced service performed by Toyota-trained technicians using genuine Toyota parts. Come in today and ask about our May tire and service offers.
No purchase necessary. Ends May 31st, 2004. Void or prohibited. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 or older with valid driver's license only. Void in Hawaii. Official rules at Toyota.com/owners.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We just had a terrific guest. It's Mr. Hillary Shelton. He's the director of the NAACP in Washington, D.C., talking about 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. The decision was made on May 17th, 1954, just 50 years ago this Monday. And I think it's a certain wonderful irony, that 50 years later, on May 17, 2004, is the first time that gay couples are allowed to get married. I think again 50 years from now, in 2054, we're going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, and they'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of gay people being able to get married. I think we should just rename May 17th Civil Rights Day. Why not? Because I think it's something that's going to be remembered. You know, Brown versus Board of Education was not something that occurred right away. It's not something where suddenly there's segregation and then they did Brown and then there's no more segregation anymore. It was actually a very slow process worked out by lawyers like Thurgood Marshall from organizations like the NAACP that achieved through time. And I think it's important that people realize all the effort that went into it. And so I want to give some of the history here. If you want to call in and discuss any issue related to Brown or racial segregation or whether we are still a separate but unequal society, call in. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or that's toll-free, 877-577-2667. You can also send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. You know, Thurgood Marshall set out to do a plan to overturn the decision of Brown versus Board of Education. It wasn't something that was done overnight. It began actually in law schools. Thurgood Marshall felt that law schools, in fact, would be the best place to test whether the court would allow blacks and whites to sit together. And there's a famous case called Painter v. Sweat, where there was a test of this issue. In fact, I believe it was Missouri, said that blacks couldn't attend the white law school. And so Thurgood Marshall pointed out that they can't get the same education if they don't sit with the white students. And so Missouri had an idea, and they actually put the black students behind a little barrier, a little like a little, not really a fence, but sort of just a little barrier, like a low fence, to separate the black students from the white students. It's really amazing when we think about the things that they went through in their day to do that. But as I said, they went step by step by step. And Brown was really just the first step of a lot of things. It was the next year in 1955 when Rosa Parks was sitting on the Montgomery Area Transit System bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and did not want to move from the front seat. When they forced her to move, she began the Montgomery bus boycott, saying famously, "My feet are tired, but my soul is rested." You know, it really took a long time. Of course, in 1955, there was Brown 2, Brown versus Board of Education 2, that said that they will desegregate the schools with all deliberate speed. Instead of saying that the decision would be issued forthwith, the way the Supreme Court normally does, they figured that segregation would take a long time to end in the South. And so it would take all deliberate speed. And then, of course, comes the Little Rock High School, where they had to send troopers in to allow the black students in. And really began the whole white segregationist uprising, probably symbolized best by presidential candidate George Wallace, because you got to remember that in those days the Democrats were the ones who supported segregation. Republicans were the party of Abraham Lincoln. It really wasn't until John F. Kennedy in 1960 that the Democratic Party became the party of civil rights. And at that time, lots and lots of white Southerners left the Democratic Party and never came back and went to the Republican Party. And that's why Jesse Helms, Strom Thurmond, all those Republicans used to be Democrats. And they changed their party because they did not want racial equality. They were very much against the idea that all men are created equal. They very much were against the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And Republicans have kept that up to this day. The racists continue to vote Republican. And they do so because it's the Democratic Party that is the party of civil rights. It's the Democratic Party that is looking and caring about the differences that still separate us. If you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. And after this break, we'll conclude with more on 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. Right after this.
Company has become a literary figure today on Hightower Radio.
Have you been chipped? Have you been chipped yet? A company called Applied Digital Solutions wants you to undergo a surgical procedure to implant a tiny RFID microchip in your arm. Why would you want to do this? Because radio frequency ID chips will eliminate the heavy burden of having to carry credit cards and remember your ATM numbers. Instead, your arm becomes your card and ID number. Simply run your arm under a scanner and your embedded radio chip sends a digital signal to the computer, allowing you to complete your transaction. ADS calls its microchip VeriPay. There's only one rational reason that ADS executives think we'll submit to this. They're insane. Insane, but serious. They insist that this technological leap is needed because many people lose their credit cards. VeriPay solves that problem, says a corporate PR flack, cheerfully noting that ADS's chip is subdermal and very difficult to lose. You don't leave it sitting in the back seat of a taxi, he said. Subdermal or not, your ID number still can be stolen by a geeky thief who rigs up a device to intercept your radio-transmitted number, then plays it back later to your ATM machine, emptying your account. If your number is stolen, or if you simply switch credit card companies or banks, what are you to do? No problem, says the PR guy. If you don't want it anymore, you can go to a doctor and have it removed. I call it an opt-out feature, he said gaily. Swell. Instead of simply calling your credit card company to cancel your card, you'd have to call a surgeon. This is progress. Still, ADS is banking on you to get chipped, as they cheerily put it, even offering a $50 discount to the first 100,000 people who sign up. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, the honchos of ADS are such business geniuses that the company's stock plummeted from $12 a share 3 years ago to about 40 cents today. I wouldn't entrust two bits to them, much less my arm.
It's difficult enough to work your way through this jungle called life every day without having to carry an 800-pound gorilla of high-interest student loans around with you. So just do what over 300,000 people have already done and call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. College Loan Corporation will gladly give you the advice you need while helping you look into interest rates as low as 2.63%, the lowest federal rates in 40 years. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
Mine too, but who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back. Guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's.
We're back here on The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. It's 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education, decided on May 17th, 1954. And that one decision, probably more than any other, was the catalyst for the Civil Rights Movement. Now, obviously, there are many things going on in the Civil Rights Movement. There was Rosa Parks, the bus boycott. There's Martin Luther King's March on Washington. There's it probably culminated the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There are lots and lots of things, but Brown really was the start, and it's interesting. It was a unanimous decision. They worked very hard to get it to be a unanimous decision, and it overturned the older decision of Plessy v. Ferguson. A lot of people don't know what Plessy v. Ferguson was about. That's a decision in 1896 where a person who was one-eighth black, the court called him an octoroon, which is, I think, as offensive as it sounds, because he was one-eighth black, was trying to ride a rail car. And the state had set aside the rail cars for blacks and whites, and they put him in the black rail car. And this guy, who after all was seven-eighths white, Mr. Plessy, was so upset by that he sued, and he lost. And he lost because the Supreme Court held in 1896 that the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, which was put in under the 14th Amendment right after the Civil War, that it guaranteed equality of outcomes, but not equality of the way people are treated. Let me explain. In other words, as long as the rail cars had equivalent seating, we could force Mr. Plessy to sit separate from the white people, and that was okay. Separate but equal was the mantra. It's perfectly fine to have separate but equal. And that lasted from 1896 to 1954. And it's interesting, and during that same time period, the same 14th Amendment that was clearly done right after the Civil War to give equality to all the freed slaves, was used to say that persons under the 14th Amendment that get equal protection includes corporations, because we all know corporations are persons. So from 1896 to 1954, corporations had more rights than persons, more rights than African Americans. But I think as we look back on it, first of all, we can see the doctrine of separate but equal used today, right, with gay marriages. There are people that say, well, civil unions are sufficient. Separate but equal is sufficient. Just don't call it marriage, and give gay people equal rights. But one of the things that Brown very much came clear on is that separate is inherently unequal. They did studies, for example, with black dolls and white dolls, and they found that little black girls actually preferred the white dolls over the black dolls, because the system of segregation was so harsh, so unequal, that they themselves felt themselves to be inferior. And that was one of the main things used to show that separate is inherently unequal and to overturn the decision in Brown versus Board of Education. I would hope if that study is done today that there would be a change, that black girls would like black dolls equally to white dolls. They wouldn't hate themselves so much. But I got to tell you, I'm not so sure. We have come away since 1954, but as Hillary Shelton pointed out, we have retreated since the 1970s. And I think that we really need a commitment to ending poverty in America, to getting people out of the cycle of poverty, to, as Hillary Shelton put it, giving people jobs, giving them homes. One-third black children are in poverty. We have no excuse for that. You know, this country, the United States of America, brought slaves to our shores. It was against their will. It is our responsibility to give everyone an equal opportunity. I hope you enjoyed the show today, and you'll tune in Sunday at 7 p.m. We're going to explore the American prison system. You know, we've talked about the tortures in Iraq. We've talked about, the vicious treatment in Abu Ghraib prison. But some of that goes on in our own prisons. Some of it goes on right here in Texas. Did you know that? We're going to explore with Jamie Fellner of the Human Rights Watch. She's going to come on my show this Sunday at 7 Eastern Time, 6 Central, 5 Mountain, and 4 Pacific, and talk about the problems in American prisons. It's not just a question of prisons abroad. And that's it for the Inside Scoop today. I hope you'll tune in on Sunday and every day next week. And if you like the Inside Scoop, do me a favor. Don't keep it a secret. This is Mark Levine signing off until Sunday.